Good morning, everybody. Okay, let's try that again. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
There we go. Oh, thank you so much. Someone said my name, which I've heard is the most beautiful word to any person to use their name, right? Well, we know that one of the most important ways that we grow spiritually is through suffering. So they asked me to speak 2 weeks in a row. And this is also... And we also decided to give you a song that is impossible to clap to and ask you to clap. Did anyone else notice that? It's a little unintentional there, but I'm really, really excited to be here again and to be able to talk about spiritual growth again, because spiritual growth is something that is really, really near and dear to my heart. It's something really important to me. In fact, I want to start today. I have something that I really have been struggling with. I'm not sure where to put it in the service. And every service I've asked them what I should do, and we've gotten different answers. So I'm going to ask you guys what you prefer. Are you guys okay with that? Okay, Edward is. I'll listen to him then. But okay, so I am not sure whether to announce that I'm expecting my first child now or later. Wait, no, you guys were listening, now or later? Now, okay. In one of the services, they actually said later. I don't think they got it. But but I'm delighted and excited about that. But I'm so committed to your spiritual growth that I decided I had to grow a child in order to have a sermon illustration. So here we go. Now, spiritual growth or growth is a huge part of what it means to be pregnant. I mean, part of it is that every day I love more and more elastic waistbands and sweats look more and more like high fashion to me every day. But not only is there the growth that I'm struggling with, but the growth, the child grows exponentially. At first, you know, they'll double in size every week as you go through the pregnancy, and then the child gains a pound a week towards the end of the pregnancy. And once they're born, they grow just as quickly. In fact, by the time they're 6 months old, they're twice the size that they were when they were born. And by the time they're a year old, they're three times the size that they were when they were born. 2 years, four times the size. Unless they're a very large child, they might be a lot more. But it's really interesting to see this exponential growth occurring, because that's very similar to the way that our spiritual growth occurs. At first, when you make the decision to follow Jesus and make the decision to make him the Lord of your life, growth happens very quickly. And significant changes happen very, very quickly, and they're very apparent to the people around you, which is awesome, because that's why so many people, when they come to Crossroads and they come to know Jesus, and then they go back into their lives, it's like people say, wow, you're so different. I want to know what it is that you have. And so then they come and they learn about Jesus and they follow Jesus. And so it has this ripple effect, which is really cool. But this week, as I'm talking about this final shift, this shift is not as apparent. In fact, it's a lot more subtle and under the surface. It's like the difference between someone who's a teenager and an adult. They look a lot more like each other. In fact, a lot of the differences between someone who is a young adult and someone who's a full-fledged adult, I'm still waiting for my card that says I'm there. I don't think I meet the height requirements. But when the differences is often a mental difference. It's a maturity difference. It's an emotional difference that's the difference between a teenager and an adult. And that's what we're really talking about here with this final shift. And it's a shift in control. Now, I just want to say that is one of the shifts that is the hardest to talk about, because people don't like it. I don't like it. I know how hard it is. But I'm going to ease us into it so we get there slowly. You guys with me? Cool. Two people. But they're right here, so I'm going to look at you guys. Okay. So we started last week with something that Dwayne introduced, and I'm going to do it again this week because it's so important. And if you're taking notes on your green outline that should have been in your program on the way in, spiritual growth is a process. Thank you. A lot of you guys were paying attention last week. Or it's behind me. I'm not sure. But spiritual growth is a process. I start there because the fact of the matter is that when we talk about these shifts, especially this is one that really takes a lifetime. And it takes a lot of just walking with Jesus over time to see this happen. And as we look at the story today, the person in the story had a complicated faith. He didn't get this perfectly, and you won't either. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the truth is, in some ways, that's freeing news to realize that this is something that as God works in our lives, we get better at it and we grow in this area. But it's not something that if you don't get it perfectly, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. So let's start there with the verses that we looked at last week. And the verses, these are kind of the key verses for the whole series. They're printed on your outline if you like to follow along. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence. Now, last week when I talked about the shift in location, that was the part that I focused on. Not just in my presence, but much more in my absence. It's not just what we do when we're in these four walls. It's not just what we do when a pastor or a leader is looking over your shoulder telling you what to do. But it's really what you do when they're not around and what happens when you go outside of these four walls. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Now, this is the part that Dwayne talked about the first week of the intentional, the shift in responsibility, that I make an intentional decision to partner with God in doing this, that there are decisions that I can make that will help me grow spiritually faster. For it is God who is at work both to will and to work for his good pleasure. It's God who is at work in you, which is the that also Dwayne brought this up, the incarnational piece. The piece that ultimately it's God who is the engine of our spiritual growth. He's the one who causes it to happen. He's the one who gives us the desire and the ability to grow spiritually. There's no spiritual growth without Jesus. Got it? So as I look through these verses, there are two words that really stick out to me, though, and that's what I'm going to focus on this week. And you might have noticed it because it seems so strange and out of place. He says to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Did anyone else notice that when I was reading it? Maybe last week, you know, you notice it and you say, wait, I get the working out your salvation piece that we partner with God, but what is this fear and trembling business? Now, if you know me, I'm a huge nerd. Love the original languages that the Bible was written in. And what it says in the original Greek here is phobos and tromos. Doesn't that sound awesome? Like, I think it increases our IQ to say it, so I want you guys to say it with me. Okay, phobos and tromos. Now, when I say phobos, do you guys recognize the English word that comes from that? Phobia, that's right. Which is a legitimate fear, right? I've seen this phrase translated as like awe and reverence, which really softens it. But these words both mean fear and fear. Like, I am terrified. And in fact, the way that they work together is it's really a trembling fear. So it's terrified. Chatter, chatter, like Scooby-Doo whenever the ghost came around. You guys know what I'm talking about. You can laugh. But really, as I read through this, I thought, what on earth is Paul talking about when he writes this? That we're supposed to work out our salvation terrified? How does that work? In the Bible, Paul often, when he writes, he'll use things that are like a key word or a key phrase that people would pick up on. And they'd get that he was talking about something else, or it was something that was related to the Old Testament. So fear and trembling is one of those things. Fear and trembling is one of those phrases that when they read it, they'd understand. And what he's talking about with fear and trembling is when you come face to face with the God of the universe. When you come face to face with God doing something that is so far beyond you that all you can do in response is to fall on your knees before him. That you recognize that there is something going on that there is no way that you could possibly instrument on your own. That you're not putting this together, you're not achieving this, which is why he says to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work. Because God is the one who causes this to happen. He's the one who will give the engine and the growth. But I really want to look at that fear and trembling piece today because we're looking at the final shift, which is a shift in control. And this is the hardest shift. Because the first week we talked about it, we related it to like, in spiritual growth, you make the decision to partner with God, a shift in responsibility. It's like you take responsibility for your part in spiritual growth. You take responsibility for the things that you can do, which is like getting into your car and coming to church, you know, coming to a place, you know, setting aside pieces of your life where you're reading the Bible or you're hearing about Jesus or you're in a small group. You're doing things specific to put yourself in a place to hear those things. And then last week I mentioned it, that the shift in location was like, so you don't just come to a place and meet with Jesus and hear about him, but that you actually, when you leave, he goes with you. And he goes with you into your family, he goes with you into your workplace, he goes with you into all of your relationships. And so there's this shift where Jesus has left the building. But this final shift, the shift in control, if you're taking notes, you recognize that this has happened when Jesus is driving the car. Now, you notice that I didn't say Jesus took the wheel because I didn't want you to get the song in your head. But I apologize because now some of you are thinking it. Yep. You guys are all thinking of Carrie Underwood now, so I apologize. But Jesus is driving the car. So it's not even that Jesus is going with you where you want to go. You've handed him the keys and you're asking him to drive where he wants you to go. And this is a really hard shift because when I talk about a shift in control, usually I think it's a good thing, but only if it means I get more control. In fact, this is one of the hardest things in all my years of working with people in ministry of really letting go of control. In fact, I'm a pretty terrible passenger. I mentioned last week that my best friend Olivia and I, how our relationship developed over time, and you know, we started to spend time together in different contexts. Well, there was this time where we were visiting for Thanksgiving. My husband and I were visiting her family in Las Vegas. And we made the worst mistake ever. So the day before Thanksgiving, we decide we're going to go to Costco. Now, Thanksgiving is a holiday all about eating massive quantities of food. And where can you buy massive quantities of food? Costco. So everybody else went to Costco that day too. And after this long trip of spending a ton of money and getting everything you could possibly think of to eat, my husband was driving us back to their house, and I was really being helpful. I was helping him know exactly how he should drive to get out of the parking lot and back home. And I mean, I was being a good wife, just trying to be a blessing, babe. And there's certain things only your best friend can say. But I hear chiming from the back seat where Olivia's sitting. Wow, Francis, I've known you for years, and I never knew you were such a backseat driver. Because only your best friend can say certain things. And I thought, backseat driver? I was being helpful. In fact, if you ask my husband today, I was just being helpful, right? Oh, yeah, that smile says it all, that he is a smart, smart man. But but there's this lack of, you know, I don't want to give up control. I don't want to let go, because what happens if everything goes wrong? What happens if we drive off the road? I won't do it. I mean, I will have perfect care of my life, but I know Jesus won't, so I need to keep control of it. And what I found as I really explore this is that it comes from a strange understanding that I had of what it means to really follow Jesus or really to grow spiritually. In fact, I was at this website a few weeks ago, and this person had posted a secret that they felt, and it really resonated. She said, "I'm afraid to love God more in fear that he will tell me to do something I don't want to do or go places I don't want to go." And I've seen this over and over again, where we're afraid to really, really follow Jesus, because what happens if we give him the keys and he takes us somewhere we don't want to go or asks us to do something we don't want to do? And I had this weird understanding of what that looked like. In fact, I always thought when I started growing spiritually, I assumed that if I became spiritual enough, if I was close enough to God, that there was this kind of hierarchy of what God would call me to do. At first, it would be, you know, leading like a youth group or something like that, and then it would be planting a church, and then it would be going to be an overseas missionary. Like, these were the things that you had to do, that everybody, if you loved Jesus enough, ultimately you had to go overseas. And I was like, oh, because I don't like change. In fact, some people tell me that I might have some changes after I have a baby, but I don't know if I believe them yet. Other than the fact that I have all these changes now. But it's interesting, because I assumed that it was like, if I loved God enough, ultimately my life would go in one direction, that my life would look one way. And I had this wrong understanding. And I would read about people in church history called pillar saints. And pillar saints were people that lived on top of a pole, like a pillar, you know, that might be like 5 feet by 5 feet, no bathroom, and they lived there year round. They would do these extreme acts to show how much they loved Jesus. But they were the people that eventually you'd go live on the pillar. In fact, I remember reading about one that had maggots crawling on him. And when they'd fall off, he'd put them back on and say, "Eat." And I thought, I don't want to love God that much. I really don't. Because I thought that these extreme devotion, like the way that people would show devotion, was eventually what would happen if I followed God long enough. And what I found is that that's a skewed understanding of the way that it works. It's kind of a caricature of the way that it looks when you really let Jesus have control of your life. In fact, when I was learning theology, we'd always talk about how there's two levels. There's one level of what you say you believe, and there's one level of what you really believe. And what you really believe is how you live your life. What you really believe is what you actually do. I mean, and you might know the right answers of what you're supposed to say you believe, but what you really believe comes out in the way that you're living your life. And so the underlying belief that I had and that I've seen in other people's lives is that the God of the universe, the one who's working to grow me spiritually, wants me to have the worst life possible. That God wants to ruin my life and make me miserable. It's his goal. And I know that's not true, but that's the way that I live my life when I refuse to let him have control of my life. That somehow he's going to drive off the road and I'm going to have the worst life possible. So what does it really look like? What does it look like to work out my salvation with fear and trembling? What does it look like for me to let Jesus have control in my life? I kept coming back to the same story as I prayed through this message, and I kept coming back to the same person, because he's really my favorite at the end of the day, because he does have a complicated faith. So the story that we're going to look at today is Jesus having a conversation with Peter. Now, Peter was one of his disciples, and he was the disciple that I love because he's the most likely to step out and step up and say things that nobody else would have done. He's the most likely to do things that nobody else would have done or said. And so I really like him because he kind of shoots from the hip and kind of makes decisions that are bold. And it's interesting because you see from the very beginning of his story, that's what he does. He starts his story following Jesus. When Jesus tells him to drop his nets, he's a fisherman, he tells him, drop his nets and follow me. And he does. Amazingly enough, not knowing Jesus, he drops his nets and he begins to follow Jesus. And then he also, if you're taking notes, you might want to write these down and you can go back and read the stories because they're not printed. He had these experiences that nobody else did. For instance, if you look in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 14, Jesus is walking on water and Peter's the one who says, if you tell me to walk on water, I'll be able to do it. And so Jesus does, and he's the only one who steps out of the boat and walks on water. He has this faith that what Jesus wants for him will happen. And then a couple chapters later in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus is asking the disciples, who do you say I am? And they start giving, you know, very political, diplomatic answers where they're saying, some people say this and some people say that. And Peter's like, no, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And they might have all been thinking that, but he's the only one who said it. And he was the only one who had the courage to say something out loud that nobody else would say out loud. So he said that, and Jesus said, you're right. And God is the one who revealed this to you, not man. So he has these experiences where he steps out and says things boldly. But Peter is complicated. I had you write those stories down because if you read them, his glorious, shining moments give way to some awful stuff. He walks on water, he steps out of the boat, and he sees the wind. Okay, another miracle that no one ever talks about. He sees the wind and he gets afraid. And he immediately starts to sink. And he's afraid of what's going on because all of a sudden his faith that he had so strongly is completely shaken. And he says, Jesus, save me. In the story where he confesses who Jesus is and he's the only one who speaks up and says who Jesus is, after that, Jesus begins teaching that he's going to suffer and die. And Peter, being as helpful as I was with my husband in the car, says, oh, no, that can't be. That's not going to happen. God forbid it. Don't worry, Jesus. I got this. It's not going to happen. And Jesus says to him, famously, get behind me, Satan. So he goes from seeing what only God could reveal to being called Satan. In like a matter of a few verses. And those are just some examples. There's a lot of other things. Like, he's the guy who cut off some poor guy's ear the night that Jesus was betrayed. It wasn't a sword fight, but he decided, well, maybe we'll fight with swords. So he grabs some guy's sword, cuts the poor servant's ear, and Jesus is like, heals the guy's ear. Sorry about Peter. Sorry about that. He's special. He's also the one who refused to let Jesus wash his feet at first. Again, I got this, Jesus. Let me help you and let you understand who you are. You're not supposed to be washing people's feet. And he argues with him and says, no. But most famously, Peter's the guy who denied even knowing Jesus on the night that he was betrayed. On the night that Jesus was arrested, people said, weren't you with that guy, Jesus? And he said, I don't know him. No, but I could have sworn I saw you. I don't know him. But I'm pretty sure I saw you with Jesus. I don't know him. Three times. He said, nope. So he'd spent 3 years following him, 3 years seeing all the miracles. The one who could admit the things that Jesus, well, the one who could recognize who Jesus was and would say it out loud, all of a sudden, I don't know him. And what happens, this story picks up after Jesus has died and after he's been resurrected. It starts very similar to the way Peter's story starts in the very beginning. He's fishing in the Sea of Galilee. They've been fishing all night and have caught nothing. So Jesus calls from the shore and says, hey, why don't you try the other side of the boat? Apparently he's a master fisherman. And they do. And they have a miraculous catch of fish. Like so many fish that the nets are practically breaking. And they recognize that it must be Jesus because they've seen this before. They recognize this. And so Peter, in true Peter fashion, he's not going to wait for the boat to actually get to the shore. He throws his clothes back on because he was probably took off his outer clothes to do the hard work of fishing. He throws his shirt back on and swims to the shore because he has to be first to see Jesus. He has to be the one who's out in front. And when he gets to the shore, when the rest of them get to the shore, they all have a breakfast together. And that's where our story picks up on your outline. After breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, Peter replied. You know I love you. Then feed my lambs, Jesus told him. Jesus repeated the question, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you, replied Peter. Then take care of my sheep. A third time he asked him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was hurt. He was hurt that Jesus kept asking him the same question. You know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, then feed my sheep. Now, there's a certain symmetry here that Peter, who denied Jesus three times, was asked to affirm that he loved Jesus three times. And there's a certain restoration that each time he'd affirm, yes, I love you, that Jesus would give him the calling that he gave him before. Again, just to remind him, feed my sheep. Do what I have called you to do in spite of all that stuff with the denial, in spite of everything. I still want you to feed my sheep. But also as I read this, I see a ramping up. And as I prayed through this, I started to see that there was a lot more going on this shore than just the question that you see printed on the page. That there's a lot more going on between these two with all of the years of context and years of walking together that you've seen between these two. And the way that I imagine it, the way that I see it, is that Jesus is also ramping up. He's really having this heart-to-heart with Peter, asking him, do you really love me? Because one of the things that Peter has struggled with, and as you see in the stories, like when he says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, the reason he can't accept Jesus being persecuted or suffering and dying is because he has a vision of what it means to be the Christ and the Son of the living God. He knows what it should look like. And what it should look like to him is that he's a conquering king who's come to overthrow his Roman oppressors. He's come to bring Israel back to this glorious kingdom for all time. And Peter would have a place in that. He would have a place of health and wealth and fame and fortune. And so there's this struggle. And you also see this in the scene where Jesus is washing the disciples' feet. And he says, no, 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 no. Again, I got this, Jesus. You're not supposed to do this. He doesn't want him to wash his feet because he cannot accept the Christ serving on his knees, doing the most humiliating job possible. And so as he's sitting there, he's struggling with this, and he does let Jesus wash his feet because Jesus says, if I don't, you have no part of me. And he's like, okay, in Peter fashion, don't just wash my feet, wash my hands and my head too. Wash everything. Give me a whole bath. I don't care. I want what you have, because he's thinking that it looks the way that he thinks that it looks. So as I see this ramping up, at first, when Jesus asks, do you love me? I could almost see the pictures in his head of what life was supposed to be like. The fame, the fortune, the health, the wealth, the acclaim, the position of power that he was supposed to have in following Jesus. Yes, I love you. But as he continues asking, it's like he's pressing, do you love me? Do you love me for who I really am? Because I've just shown you, when I died on the cross, who I really am. Do you love me? Do you love me as I chose to present myself as a baby? A baby born in a manger, a baby who needed parents to take care of him. Do you love me when I came, even though I was God, when I came in the form of a human being and a servant? Do you love who I really am? Do you love me even though I got down on my knees and washed the feet of the person who would betray me that night, the person who would deny me that night, and the people who would immediately desert me? Do you love me when I serve them? Do you love me when I gave up my life, when I chose to give up my life in the most humiliating way possible? When I chose the way of suffering and death to bring life? Do you love me when it does nothing for your reputation? When it does nothing to do the things that you think it ought to do in your life, do you still love me? Your view of a coming king is too small. Your view of who I am is too narrow. And he's asking this question, this heart-to-heart question, which I believe he asks every one of us. Do you love me for who I really am? Because he's about to ask him for everything. He says, I tell you the truth, when you were young, you were able to do as you liked. You dressed yourself and went wherever you wanted to go. You got to drive the car. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and others will dress you and take you where you don't want to go. And he said this to let him know by what kind of death he would glorify God. He said this to let him know that he would glorify God through his death. This is that fear and trembling moment of realizing that God, the God of the universe, has something so much bigger that he wants to do with our life than often we think he does, or that even we know. And then Jesus told him, in light of all that, in light of everything he just said, he says, follow me. If you're taking notes, I want you to circle that, because his call is the same as it was the very first time he met Peter. Follow me. And it's interesting because it's so different this time. He's kind of pulling back a little bit of the curtain to show Peter what it might look like to follow him. And I think that a lot of times we think that following Jesus will look one way. Like I thought, if I follow Jesus, I'll be a missionary eventually. If I love Jesus enough, that's the only way that my life can turn out. But the truth is, it looks very different. In fact, most of us, we won't physically die if we follow Jesus. Like, it's not going to lead to that. But for a lot of us, it's a very different kind of death, a more painful death. Sometimes it's a death of who you thought Jesus was and recognizing who he actually is and recognizing that he's not here to do our bidding and he's not here to make our lives and what we want better. Sometimes it's the death of a dream of what you were sure your life would look like, of something that you were sure God wanted to do through you. And sometimes it's just the death of recognizing that life isn't the way it's supposed to be and feeling that sense of I don't have control over everything that I thought I did. But ultimately, it is a death of our control. At the end of the day, following Jesus does represent letting go of us having the ability to say, Jesus, I got this. I know how my life's supposed to be. Let me take care of it. And I think it's funny that so many of us think that it looks one way. Because for me, even though I'm excited about having kids, that was not in my plan. In fact, it was something that as I prayed and I with my husband and I, we went on a prayer retreat because I thought, well, how are we going to minister together? You know, we both had been through seminary and what can we do as a team? And when I opened my Bible and really prayed, God, show me what you want. He showed me that he wanted us to have kids. And I was like, wait, Jesus, no. I went through seminary and I did all this stuff. I want to do all my ministry outside. And he's like, well, I want to do my ministry inside of you. And there's this process that even though I'm excited about it, I'm terrified because I have very clear understanding that I am out of control right now. Like that I'm not in control of my life anymore. You know, that God is in fact the author of life. He's the one who gave this child to me, and he's the one who brought this desire into my heart. Not what I was expecting, but it isn't the worst life possible. Well, I'll let you know in a few months. or maybe like 15 years, right? Our parents of teenagers out here. Oh, 10, okay. So, but it's interesting because it just represents allowing God to do in my life what he wants to do in my life. And I have a testimony that I'd like to share with you that's one of our council members who's let Jesus control the direction of his life, and it doesn't look exactly like what you might expect it would. So check this out. What I love about John's story is that following Jesus and making himself available has looked like going into his workplace and being able to have conversations and be able to share things that other people would not have access to. You know, me who sits in a church all day, I meet a lot of Christians, but I don't always get to meet a lot of people who aren't. And so it's interesting just to recognize that following Jesus will look very different for each of us. In fact, the last part of the story, Peter turns around after Jesus says, follow me. And he saw behind him the disciple Jesus loved. I just want to point out that it's always cracked me up that the only time John, who wrote the Gospel of John that this story is printed in, is called the disciple whom Jesus loved, is in the Gospel of John. So really, I think he missed that lesson in Sunday school where they taught about Joseph and how he was the favorite child. And so his brothers took him and threw him in a pit and sold him into slavery. I think John must have missed that to write that he's the disciple whom Jesus loved over and over again. Anyhow, that's an aside you don't need to know. Just my opinion. Peter turned around and saw Mr. Humility behind him. And he said, well, what about him, Lord? And Jesus replied, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? As for you, follow me. If you're taking notes, circle that again. You follow me. A lot of times as we journey in our spiritual life, we look around us and think, well, I want what they have. I want what that person is blessed with or what that person's doing. I want to do that, not what Jesus is calling me to do. But this calling, you follow me, is ultimately what he calls to each one of us. And I love that this story comes full circle, because the very way that Peter's life with Jesus started, saying, follow me, is how this conversation ends. Follow me. And the truth is, the very thing that starts our spiritual journey of saying yes to Jesus, saying, yes, I'm going to follow you, is exactly what happens as we get deeper and deeper. But it's almost like the difference between when you go to a wedding and people make the vows for better, for poor, or for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. There we go. When they make those vows, they genuinely mean them, but they have no idea what that is going to look like. They have no idea what's going to happen after they make those vows, and they genuinely mean it. But after you go through 10, 20, 30 years of marriage, when you renew those vows, you kind of know a little bit more what's going on. Like, you have a deeper sense of what this looks like. So there's this commitment that we make, even after following Jesus for years, the commitment is the same. Follow me. You know more what it's going to cost you, but it's the same call. Follow me. If you guys are outline ninjas, that's what we used to call ourselves, and we could fill in the outline before it came up on the screen. The last thing, how do I make this shift? It's follow Jesus. The same commitment that you can make today, if it's the first time and you're feeling that stirring, like, I want to follow. I don't know what it means, but I want to follow because I want him to do the work that only he can. I want him to take my life where only he will. You can make that commitment if you've been following Jesus for a long time. And it might be just, I'm here. I'm here, Lord. It hurts, and I'm here. But I'm committing to follow you wherever it takes me, because I love you, because I know your love for me. Now, I love to give you guys, like, your to-do. It's simple, but it's not easy. So I really want to pray for us as we end today, just to, because we need it. In order to do this, we ultimately need prayer. So would you guys pray with me? Heavenly Father, I pray that you would be speaking to each one of us, that you would use your Holy Spirit, that you would use the people around us, that you would use your word to show us what it means to follow you. God, I pray that you would give each one of us the courage to follow you wherever we're at, to take that next step, to understand, God, that you are doing the heavy lifting, that you are ultimately the God of the universe who's in control, but who is also so intimately involved in our life and our growth. And God, I pray that you'd give us the courage to step out and step up and to shift. And God, I pray that we would have a life that we never expected, but that is one that is so much better than we could have even imagined for ourselves, because we live it in close proximity to you, that we live it every day depending on your grace and your presence to get us through it. God, I pray that you would just cause each one of us to follow you in a deeper way this week than we did last week. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.